If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
John Waters is an Irish thinker, talker, and writer. From the life of the spirit of society to the infinite reach of rock and roll, from the puzzle of the human eye to the true nature of money, from the attempted murder of fatherhood to the slow death of the novel, he speaks and writes about the meaning of life in the modern world. He began part-time work as a journalist in 81 with Hot Press, Ireland's leading rock and roll magazine. He went full-time in 1984 when he moved from the Wild West to the capital, Dublin. As a journalist, magazine editor and columnist, he specialized from the start in raising unpopular issues of public importance, including the psychic cost of colonialism and the denial of rights to fathers under what is called family law. He was a columnist with the Irish Times for 24 years, when being Ireland's premier newspaper still meant something. He drew the blinds fully on Irish journalism in around 2015. And since then, his articles have appeared in publications such as First Things, frontpagemag.com, The Spectator, Spectator USA. He's published 10 books. The latest, Give Us Back the Bad Roads, 2018, a reflection on the cultural disintegration of Ireland since 1990, in the form of a letter to his late father. That's the big intro. John Waters, thanks for sitting through it. It was all about you anyway.
Thank you very much, Paul. Nice to be here.
Okay, I'm just curious, get into a whole lot of stuff. Just curious, in that that letter that you wrote to your late father, what did you say?
He died in 1989. I wrote it in 2018, or published it in 2018. So it was about what had happened to Ireland in the interim between his death and that moment. And it was quite a graphic picture because Ireland had really radically degenerated. He was my father was very political in the small p sense.
Yeah,
you know, he just was fascinated with politics and talked about it all the time with his friends and on the road. He drove a mail car, which was really a kind of a stagecoach going around of Ireland, you know. And so he like really, Ireland had suddenly, as though overnight, sometime around 2013, 14, just fallen off a cliff politically, you know, psychologically, morally, in all kinds of ways, because you had this sudden a raft of crazy stuff coming in, what we now recognize as wokeism. And we had a government which had been elected as kind of, you know, middle-of-the-road conservative, and suddenly it was out there radical leftist stuff that nobody had asked for and nobody had voted for. So I became, as it were, a casualty of this, because I was in the Irish Times, and suddenly, overnight, my colleagues started to attack me on Twitter. Like, it's something, when I went to the Irish Times, like, there was these protocols, like, that you represented, this was Ireland's newspaper of record. Mm. It was a very somber thing to be working for. I even wore a tie for a few months when I joined, you know, back in 1990.
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly, these people were just licensed to go off after me, a columnist, just doing my job in my newspaper as I'd been employed to do for 24 years. And suddenly, I was I was the hare and they were the hounds in this new game that suddenly had erupted. And so it was kind of about that. And I left the Irish Times in 2014. I went to work with another newspaper briefly. But then I quit there in the middle of 2015. And I now have my own Substack, johnwaters.substack.com. But I don't really consider myself a journalist. I think journalism has now become a criminal profession because of the way that it's now acting as, you know, it has basically flipped its business model from telling the truth, or trying to basically telling lies every day, all day.
I was in the public broadcaster for a long time, and I'm relating to what you're saying. You know, there was kind of a flipping point, seems to me to be sometime in the 2010s, early 2010s, maybe the first signs of it. But it wasn't frog in a pot, was it? It wasn't slow. It happened pretty quick. How do you explain that?
Well, it was extraordinarily quick, because I did a study of this in my book in the context of what we call gay marriage, because we had a referendum in 2015, and which wasn't really the introduction of gay marriage. It was basically the overturning of the entire definitions constitutionally of the words marriage, family and parenthood. Because it essentially put a grenade in there and blew the heart out of it, you know? Yeah. And so, I did a study of this, like, just on the, predicated on the very bizarre kind of experience I'd had, where, you know, I'd been attacked even before I opened my mouth on the question of gay marriage, because it was assumed I was going to do so, because I'd been fighting for years for fathers' rights, you know, because fathers are treated abominably by family law courts, and whether it's single fathers or, you know, married fathers who are separated or divorced, and they get a really raw deal and still do. But, you know, this, nobody would ever want, do anything about this. Politicians weren't interested in hearing about it. But suddenly this other right out there on the complete margins was being elevated as the most important right of our generation. So I did a bit of an investigation, and I went back to the editorials and articles in the Irish Times, going back 20, 25 years, for the first signs of talk about gay marriage. And they were really only like a couple of years before, and then very tentative. And in fact, the editorial policy of the Irish Times up to the year before had been counter to the idea of gay marriage, on the basis that it was going to precisely destroy the definition, damage the existing model of marriage, which was between a man and a woman. And I wrote up all this, and nobody seemed to kind of think it was in any way significant or important, you see. So there was what you would call, or what you might have at the time called, a kind of a collective derangement that kind of really affected almost a huge tranches of the population.
Like a contagion that sort of rippled through.
That's right. That's right. That suddenly there was this kind of, as I say, it was like that on the Tuesday before last, everybody had a dream. Everybody had the same dream that they'd never had before, and or mostly most people had. And they all woke up and decided that gay rights, gay marriage was the most important right of a generation. This would be in their dream. And anybody who didn't have that dream was a homophobe and had to be excoriated and cancelled and driven out of right-thinking society. That was the way it seemed from the outside. And of course, we now realize that all of this was top-down imposed. This is part of a plan not to introduce gay marriage per se, not to have any concern for gay rights or gay people in any way whatsoever, but to use the muscle which had been acquired by this lobby group to break down the institutional structures of societies, and by extension of Western civilization. And that's essentially what all this was about. And when you go to any other area, whether it's trans or, you know, migration, or you go back, you know, to feminism, go back to third wave feminism in the early 90s, it kind of seemed to escalate from that. And all of that that connectivity between those different issues was starting to be, tuned up. And so that's really what's going on. What we now understand is really a war against Western civilization being driven from within.
Yeah, it didn't sort of become a short-term fad, because it's built on now, isn't it? The whole trans thing slid in on that. And
yes,
again, you know, I don't know what proportion of the public think a particular way, but no one questions it. They just sail on with it.
Well, exactly. But, you know, I have a name for that. I call that mutism. That this has, people have been, the population has been muted, or they're suffering from what I call kind of collective lockjaw.
Yeah.
And that's an imposed condition. It's precisely because of starting with the LGBT goons, as I call them, who were basically let out as attack dogs to savage anybody who seemed to want to question anything, any aspect whatsoever, or even to have a discussion about it. No discussion was permitted. We were now told, this is now the time for this, shut up and go away, or we'll deal with you. And that was the vibe. And basically what that did in my country, which used to be I would say, the most argumentative, garrulous and talkative country on earth. Suddenly everybody lapsed into a sullen silence, like, because they were terrified of even thinking something in public that would register on their faces and that they would accordingly be attacked by one of these guys. And as a result, people started looking over their shoulders if you were having a conversation with them. And if the conversation strayed into any potentially even close to, two fields away from a potentially contentious area, they would start They would climb up and start looking over their shoulders to make sure that they were well away from the nearest eavesdropper, you know. And this is not a healthy way for a democratic society to develop. But the politicians that we had welcomed this. They welcome this. And you can see this being extended now in all kinds of directions. They want to maintain it and enforce it. They have these hate speech laws, which they call. But of course, what they are is hatred of speech laws, you know, that they don't want the people talking. That's it. You know, really, when you look back at the lockdown, or indeed, we kind of intuited this at the time. The lockdown and the way these public houses were closed and shops were closed and cafes were closed and so on, it was really at its heart an attempt to isolate people into individuals so they couldn't communicate. So they would destroy that connectivity that is vital for free democratic societies in order to, so that, you know, as John Stuart Mill wrote over 100 years ago, you know, that you have to have a society in which, you know, the even the wrong-headed or apparently wrong-headed view of one person is, you know, validated and facilitated because of the chances that even the remote chance that person may be right. And he said, even that if that person is wrong, society will benefit from this discussion because it will be strengthened in the certitude of its our existing view. All this is lost now as we are dealing with ideological forces in the control of supranational elite, so-called elites, E-lister, I call them, tyrants seeking to impose their will on society. And extraordinarily, this is the extraordinary thing, the way that all of civil society, all of our civil liberties groups, all of our liberals, all of the people who had talked about freedom and decency and truth and justice for years and years and years, suddenly they muted themselves. They just pushed the mute button and said nothing for several years while all this was happening.
Wow, that's a lot to take in. It seems, and I was thinking as you're saying that not only, you know, there are all sorts of issues, but they all do seem to have a separating of people effect.
Yes.
There's a common denominator, isn't it?
It is, yes, they do. And the demoralization of people in accompanying that, you know, that people are subjected to these absolutely obscene and bizarre.
In the trans world, for example, you know, if you're transitioning kids without their parents' knowledge at an age where they're too young for that, no matter what, then you are dividing at a fundamental level humans.
That's right. And, you know, very interesting in Ireland, back in 2012, and your date about 2010 is very apt, I think. In 2012, we had a referendum, a constitutional referendum, to allegedly introduce children's rights into the constitution. Of course, on closer examination, it turned out what it was, you know, transferring parental rights to the state. Obviously, you know, if you have a 2-year-old toddler crawling around the mat, you know, he or she can't really hire lawyers and go to the High Court. You know, somebody has to exercise those rights. And of course, normally it's the parents, and rightly it's the parents that who are the custodians of those rights. But this referendum transferred those rights to the state, which now has the effect, which we didn't foresee, even though we fought this on principle, because it would give too much power to the state and lower the threshold of involvement by the state in the family. Even what we didn't foresee back in 2012, this trans thing, which now has the effect of blocking parents from protecting their own children when they're in the gravest of danger from this ideological contagion, which is a most, I don't know what you would say about it. It's maddening, it's saddening, it's devastating to see that this catastrophe is having to unfold now in front of our eyes, and there's nothing very much anybody can do about it until the consequences become manifest in whatever, a decade or two.
Here's a left field question for you. Where has rock and roll been in all of this?
Oh boy, that's a really good question. Not there, apart from a very tiny number of people, which I could list, and you know, I could say, you know, Van Morrison, our great, the great Irish troubadour, Eric Clapton, you know, the formerly known as God, the greatest guitarist, they say. No, no, he's not. Rory Gallagher, an Irishman, was the greatest blues guitarist.
I was a fan.
In the world ever. But Morrissey was present for a while. You know, there was. Then there's a guy, I forget now the names. Sorry, there were a few. But you see, really, what we have found.
Right, said Fred.
Yeah. What we have found with rock and roll generally is that it is captured. That it is captured by the left, by a left-wing ideology. And this has endured far longer than common sense or anything else might have predicted, in the sense that, you know, the world has changed radically under its feet and it appears not to have noticed. It's still clinging to those tropes that belong, you know, in the United States in the 60s or in South Africa in the 70s, 80s. You know, this idea that, you know, of oppressed peoples in a particular narrow context and, you know, racism, all of these concepts, they're all central to the way that rock and roll culture or the surrounding culture has developed. So that exactly, you know, and John Lydon is another person who's been very outspoken on this kind of thing, and very clearly. So that, you know, those guys seem to understand intuitively that rock and roll is something that changes, it transmogrifies in the context of changing realities, and they're changing with them. But they meet with bafflement from the establishment of the music and the industry, because, you know, that's the way that the ideology is constructed. And of course, the controlling forces control the money ultimately.
And that's
what speaks.
And I'm thinking, as you're saying that, remember, I think Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, though Crosby might not have been part of that at that point, they all pulled music from Spotify because of, I think, one of Joe Rogan's guests, one of the COVID doctors, let's say, and they pulled the pin. Though you listen to some of this, Neil Young, you listen to some of their songs, and you know, they're really talking about very deep things that are thought out, and you're wondering how come they don't get freedom of speech, and it's difficult to listen again, you know?
It's very difficult, and you really have to kind of almost have this schizophrenic view of time and over the past say 60 years that somehow, you know, they were in tune with reality for a long time or appeared to be, and then suddenly one day the reality took off from under their feet and they weren't able to catch up with it. They weren't able to understand what was happening because they couldn't find themselves saying things that seemed to grate with or contradict the things they had earlier said. But the fact is that that's what morally and ethically the music should have been doing, because that's what it would have been doing if it had been left in its natural environment. It would have responded governed by an ethic of justice, if that had happened, and would have taken the side of those who were being trodden underfoot, as it had always. But now it was on the side of the oligarchs who wanted to impose all of these new conditions on society using proxies, you know, pseudo-victims of various kinds, whether it was gays or black people or whatever it would be, and trans. And these, all that the these artists, so-called, could see was the victim. Victimhood. They couldn't see through to the pseudo nature of that victimhood, the way that was really constructed ideologically in order to batter down the structures of Western civilization. And that's where we are now. Like that, you know, we find that not just with rock and rollers, but also with novelists. You know, who write novels now. There was a novel that won the Booker Prize recently, Prophet's Song, by an Irish guy called Paul Lynch, which is about, you know, a totalitarian putsch of Ireland, of the Irish government. Now, I when I saw this blurb first, I said, oh, this is it. It's our Solzhenitsyn, you know, it's our Solzhenitsyn. But no, it's about a far-right putsch. It's got nothing to do with what actually happened in reality. It's absolutely unbelievable, really, that this could have happened, that this book could have been written, because it was written in the years 20, 21 and 22, in which the most unprecedented events in the entirety of Western civilization, in a very negative way, had happened.
There's so much to talk about, so many angles. Is it, and I might be jumping a bit too far ahead, can this be walked back?
Oh boy, that's a hard one. Well, I wish I could say for certain that it could. And I mean that, I guess, first off, in my lifetime, first, you know, instinctively, you know, you want to see peace again, you want to see justice again, you want to see decency again. I'm beginning to lose my optimism on that score. But I do think in the longer term, it will be walked back, because humanity always rises to the occasion. You know, it may take a while. People may be lulled into complacency by money and prosperity and, you know, propaganda and so on. But ultimately, they awaken. And indeed, in my own country, Ireland, now, I have to say, in the last couple of months, there has been a really signs of an eruption of that kind of consciousness. Because we had a couple of referendums here a month ago, which were designed to again attack the Irish Constitution at the most fundamental level, at the level of the personal fundamental rights, the kind of Bill of Rights section, if you like. And they were about, you know, the woman in the home, mothers in the home, one of them, and then the definitions of family. And all of the political parties were on the yes side of those. They were trounced 70-30.
Yep.
It was absolutely astonishing. And what it seems to me is that what happened was that mutism, the people who couldn't speak found an outlet in that corner, yep, of the polling booth with their pencil, where they could make that X, and that in a strange way, that the last vestige of the Irish Republic survived in that corner.
Yeah, and right there.
This massive, you know, whisper to turn into a massive roar of no, no, no. And this is really encouraging. And since that, we've had the resignation of our appalling Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, which is wonderful, except for that his successor is actually, and I shudder and hesitate to say this, that because it doesn't seem possible that these words could ever be uttered, that the successor of Leo Varadkar is actually worse than Leo Varadkar. It's incomprehensible. It doesn't make any sense. But still, I have to say it because it kind of is true. The new guy is a guy called Simon Harris. He's a piece of work, really, you know. He is in the Ardern category. He is in the Boris Johnson. He is everything.
So would his background be your classic, because Steve Varadkar came up. He's been basically a politician virtually all his adult life, hasn't he? Come up that way. Is that the same for Prime Minister?
Same thing, yeah. But politicians,
so this is the pattern that emerges now.
It is, but you see, they're politicians of an entirely different kind to even the breeds that I would have grown up with, you know, who were kind of professional politicians who had a particular view of their society in its true nature. These are guys who are attacking the society, and really they are World Economic Forum puppets, really, all of them.
Right, yeah.
They're trained there at very high expense they graduate with masters in tyranny and totalitarianism and yeah, so on. And this guy has got, you know, he got top marks in all those categories. I can tell you, you know, he wanted to compulsorily vaccinate children or ban them from school if they weren't vaccinated and so on. People are thinking that, for example, the hate speech laws, which have still not been passed, and which Varadkar even hesitated because the backlash worldwide was so extraordinary to the Irish hate speech laws, which really were, until Trudeau actually managed to outdo us under a couple of headings. They were the worst in the world ever. But Trudeau can always be counted upon to be worse than anybody else.
Yeah, he does that. He goes for the Olympics on that.
He does, yeah. He's got all the gold medals there. And so these guys, we have reached a stage now, Paul, where you know, democracy is dead. I mean, it's not a rhetorical statement. It's just literally true. That what matters now is not really the vote, except in that one referendum. It's not really the vote of the people, because it doesn't matter what the people say now. The same things happen anyway.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you know the roar? Is the roar heard? Because a politician makes a calculation. X amount of support means I get elected. So you sort of go where the needle points. But these politicians may ignore that.
Oh, they do. I mean, I have been saying for the last couple of years that there was in Ireland in 2011 what the Spanish call an autogolpe, a self-coup, which the purpose of which is to ensure that the incumbent government never gets put out of power. And if you look at what's happened, we've had two elections since then. We're due to have another one the next year. And despite all of that, we've had 13 years where a party which has been stuffed twice in elections, Fine Gael, is still leading the government. Its leader is going to be the Taoiseach. And we went from a Taoiseach in the beginning, a Prime Minister in 2011, who, for all kinds of complicated reasons and you know, not naturalistically, I can tell you, not organically, got an overall majority with a smaller party. Still, nevertheless, an overall majority. That we've now reached a stage where a government which is support, which comprises two parties who are, you know, who have been at war with each other for 100 years, are now in collusion, who always said they would never coalesce with the other, each of them. And now we're about to we're about to watch a ceremony in which a Prime Minister Taoiseach, who was elected on the fifth count in his own constituency in the last election, the fifth count. I mean, normally Taoiseach would get, incumbent Taoiseach would get like three quotas in an election. He's going to hand over to a guy who got elected on the 15th count in his constituency.
Crikey. Oh, dear. That's pretty low resolution, isn't it?
Well, I'm saying myself and yourself, Paul, probably have very close to the same mandate to rule Ireland or rule the world for that matter, you know. But it doesn't seem to matter anymore. And nobody comments on this because all the journalists are all bought and paid for. This is the most shocking thing of all, the prostitutization of our media, where they just now become, they have flipped their model from telling the truth to telling lies, and they're happy with that. Well, and indeed, you can see incidentally that the Taoiseach in waiting, the Taoiseach elect, if you want to call him that, I don't know if that's technically correct. But he has now announced the appointment of three senior so-called journalists as his advisors.
Oh, dear.
These are people who are supposed to be calling a power to account. And the next thing, they're lining up to work for the tyrant.
Well, we have a bit of a revolving door like that here, I have to say. We're a small country. The thing is, though, here, the mainstream media businesses are starting to get into business hardship. Their advertising model's falling away, and they haven't been, generating or curating new audiences, which would be further along or away from the left, let's say, than maybe the current leaning. And their business is under stress, so this could take them out that way. Is there any prospect? Is that how the media business in Ireland works?
Yes, it is. And there are those signs here as well of the thing, the business model is beginning to crack now. People are beginning to sense that they're not being told the truth. As I say, what is actually happening is that they're being enclosed on a daily basis in a pseudo-reality when their eyes and ears are subject to a certain thing which are nothing to do with what's actually going on. And so there are signs of that. The other thing that is happening is that incrementally, osmotically, the alternative media, the guerrilla media, you know, people like yourself and myself, are beginning. We're gradually encroaching. We're gradually growing, little by little. And one day they wake up and realize that there's actually been another coup, and we're it.
Yep. And the phones on the other side start to ring then.
Yes. That's the way. I mean, it is.
You got any jobs? You know. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because, of course, this is an entirely different model of media. It's not that centralized control model that you have in the mainstream, and you've always had that to some extent. But it's chaotic, and it's very individuals working in together or separately, some people, you know, you have to as it were, consumer of it, you have to learn your sources. You have to work your way through it. So it's a different thing than simply pushing one button or picking up one title in the newsstand. And people need to be, I suppose, educated into that because it's a hard thing to accept that you can still find out the truth in that way. But we know that you can in a much more complex and much more satisfying way, that gradually you construct your own edifice of what's happening. And you can, you know, from the various elements that you've come to trust.
Yeah, you can discern.
And it's much more reliable than simply taking your feed from one source, which is essentially what mass media has become.
It's amazing when you think about it. We're coming up against time here. It's amazing when you think about it that actually it's like some kind of movie. There are lots of people living in what is an information bubble that they're unaware that they're in.
Yes.
That's what that is, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And it has all these kind of internal undertows, you know, which they're not conscious of. For example, one of the things that's happened in the COVID period is that the kind of idea of consequences for power has been removed from the equation entirely. You know, that kind of sense you had one time when there was a political scandal of whether it was a sexual or a financial or whatever it might be, and one politician might be at the center of that storm. And you knew instinctively from past experience that, you know, he only had days to live, as it were, and that the consequences would never...
He was gone.
That one more straw on the camel's back was enough to break it, you know? And that would, you could predict it on that basis. That's no longer true now. You know that thing that you see, some news comes out about relation to whatever it might be, you know, mass injections or, you know, things like that. And you think, this is it now. Your old instinct kicks in and you think,
we're going to get them now.
Yeah. And then a few hours later, you realize, no, we're not. No, we're not.
Because nowhere near.
The media is completely corrupt, and that bubble, as you say, is making sure that people, not that it's not even that they don't know about the event. They may well know about it. The media may tell them, but what they won't tell them is the significance of it. They will not emphasize the meaning of it. I mean, we had a rule in journalism. I don't know if you've ever heard it, but there are three rules in journalism. An old friend of mine, who was a great journalist, used to say, there are three rules. He says, first, you tell them what you're going to tell them. Then you tell them what you've told them. And once you take that element out, when you take one of those elements out, people no longer have the certainty that they would have if they heard the same thing from multiple sources and we're all talking about it together. When it's kind of isolated, put on page 17, the bottom left-hand corner, it doesn't even, it's deniably there, but it's not, as it were, true, or it doesn't feel like truth anymore.
What do you make then of the Western world versus everywhere else? Because, you know, a lot of what you've been describing in Ireland kind of in a way is similar to what's happening here, with obviously the differences that we have. But it's following on most things the same track. And it seems that our neighbor Australia, you mentioned Canada, United States, you know, very set bunch of countries, nationalities, though there are European countries, I know, in this sort of space as well. But, you know, there's a lot of the world that's not afflicted by this, do you think?
Yeah, it's a West-wide situation, really, isn't it? It's an attack on the... It's a war on the West. These people who are doing this don't seem to have the immediate priority of dealing with the rest of the world. They want to take down the West. And that's a very interesting thing in lots of ways, apart from all the other things you might say about it. Why, you know, that they want to start at the top of the tree. They want to take out the jewel of the modern civilization. And there's a real dilemma there, Paul, because, you know, in the last few years, we've been watching like the conflict in Ukraine, and we've been watching Putin and listening to Putin and watching China and so on. And, you know, sometimes you actually stand back and you say, you know, who are the tyrants now? Who are the real tyrants?
I know what you're saying.
There are guys. There are guys, you say, okay? They're really, despite what they say, and in fact, maybe because of what they say, the propaganda, you say, no, there are guys. But then you have to stop, Paul, and say, and this is something I'm still struggling with, that is true, but, you know, can we conceivably throw ourselves in the arms of Putin and Xi? You know, it seems an implausible scenario. It seems an unwise strategy.
Maybe Putin?
I mean, when you listen to Putin, you have to say, I mean, the way I kind of try to put it to people, rather than sounding like I'm one of his fanboys, is to simply say, well, if we had a lawyer, if we had a politician, a leader, who spoke of Ireland as he speaks of Russia, would we not be in heaven?
Yes.
Yes. Or New Zealand or Australia. That instead of Trudeau, you had somebody who spoke of Canada with the affection and the sincerity and intelligence that Putin brings to his discussions about his country, would you not say this is what a leader ought to be?
I thought it was very telling in the Tucker Carlson interview, the reaction to that interview. A lot of people criticized Putin for, you know, what they made out to be a rambling sort of random history lesson.
Yes.
But I thought, don't know, there could be something wrong with me, but I thought he was actually sending a message in a way, which which said, okay, you know what your problem is? You don't know your blooming history.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had that wrong instinct to begin with, you know, about why he was doing this. But I'd forgotten, I mean, really stupidly forgotten, that he was speaking now to a new audience. He knew that he was speaking not to us who had been listening for 2 years to him, you know, because we had heard this before.
It's the first time viewer because of the Tucker Carlson profile.
Yeah, this enormous audience, and he realized that he had to start from scratch and tell them. And of course, we had heard it all before and we wanted him to move on into other areas. But no. What was his priority was to broaden the reach of the reach of his message, which is actually a very good message in from the point of view of civilization. You know, like this is what a civilized country ought to sound like, more or less, in terms of the way it talks about values, the way it talks about humanity, the way it talks about, you know, history. But you see, everything is distorted now in this pseudo-reality. So, you know, you could go into a room where there was a TV set on in New Zealand or Ireland, and you would be hearing an entirely different version of this. And that's a very arresting thing for people to have to deal with, you know, that suddenly, you know, what you kind of intuitively thought or felt from some experience you had of, say, listening to someone like Putin is completely overturned by the other propagandized version from the West Central Intelligence, if such it can be called. And this is now, I think, the great problem we have, that everything is distorted. We really do, if we get out of this, I keep saying this, if we get out of this, the first thing we're going to have to do is you know, outlaw all forms of behavioral psychology, all forms of propaganda, all these things which have destroyed our democracies and our civilization particularly in the last 4 years.
You do fine tune to it. One thing I've noticed now is I have quite a quick reaction to what I'm hearing, and I've made up my mind what I think it is, you know, within seconds now. So it shows through when you kind of know what to look for, you know.
That's right, and you're not as alarmed or as you know by it as it might have been a few years ago, or
no
dismayed. Yeah, no, you can adjust to it. You know what exactly? You know what it is. You know everything about, say, Trump or whatever. You can read it for what it is, more or less. But you know, then you look at. There are certain elements, though, that are not to me so clear. I mean, I wonder if what's afoot at the moment with the World Economic Forum is a kind of a movie that they're putting on for us, you know, and we have the bad guys who are proposing all of these.
Oh, so that's like a deflection play, in a way.
And you have the arch villain in Klaus Schwab, you know, there, you know, with the strange German accent.
Well, you're right about that because he's central casting right there.
Yes. But then you have to then ask, well, what would be the next act? And when we get to act three, what would that be? Well, that would be the cavalry coming over the hill, wouldn't it? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And who is that? Would that, for example, be, I don't know. You see, didn't you get into this sort of nouveau conspiracy stuff, which is like, will that be, I don't know, Elon Musk? Will he be in the front of the cavalry when it comes down the hill to tell us everything's okay, you're all rescued? And then do what? Maybe do pretty much the same thing as Klaus Schwab was going to do anyway. You know, because when you actually look at his CV, that's essentially what you find there. So I don't know. You see, you kind of have to. I use a metaphor here in my life as a journalist and as a writer or whatever, a commentator, of the dry stone wall, which is an old Irish art form, you know, where you build walls without stones and without cement or mortar. And the idea is that you just make the stones all fit together. So I kind of think of myself as surrounded by piles of different shaped stones, and I'm trying to build my wall, and I have a space, and I try out different stones, and I can't find one that fits. So I just wait, you know, until I go somewhere else in the wall and I work on that, and then I come back and, oh, there's one now. That fits. And it's that with all the thoughts that are coming into us all the time and all the new different theories and hypotheses, we really have to, in this new model of media, this new fourth estate that we're now involved in that isn't like the mainstream media, we have to try do all that to test out each thesis. So it means that we have to activate our minds in front of every new discussion and ask ask ourselves, well, do I trust this person? Does this person sound reliable? Does this sound like a workable hypothesis? And so on. And so I think that's a really good development, even though it's in its early stages yet. And it may well end up in creating at one day, long after we're gone, Paul, I'm afraid to say, a civilization far better even than the one we've lived through.
Well, I would hope. I would hope.
Yes.
And you know, we try hard. Of course, we're just about to wind up. Of course, the business model has to change, and there's an element of direct support now from people who are motivated to support their media, I don't know, maybe a multiple choice or choice, and that sort of falls outside the strict advertising market. If you can get followings, paying subscribers in large numbers, at some point you start to influence more than just the media landscape, wouldn't you?
Yes, indeed, you do, yeah. And
you start persuading people to think your way.
And yes, and but also there's that sense in which that is a kind of an advanced form of democracy, you know, that people are voting with their money, as it were, in small amounts.
Yeah.
For somebody who they see to be moving in the right direction.
And they wouldn't give you money if they didn't think there was something in it. And that's the real test.
Yes, yes. Whereas the opposite is happening with the mainstream media, that they're losing the mandate that they received to the exchange of money over the counter for their products in the past, which is actually quite a wonderful model for a very long time. But they destroyed it because of the internet, because the internet kind of forced upon them a model whereby they had to give their products away. And consequently, they were no longer able to maintain the business model they had been operating. So they opted to flip it and tell lies instead.
It's been fascinating chatting with you, John Waters. Thank you for coming on our radio station.
Thank you, Paul. That's very interesting and nice to talk to you.
I think I've already asked you if we're going to get through it. It's just the time period, how long it takes to shimmy on by the latest challenge. And this is really, in civilization terms, just another challenge, isn't it?
It is, yeah. What we can't necessarily read is the level of intelligence or cunning of the people we're up against, because they're hidden from our view. I vacillate between believing that they're kind of geniuses to be thinking they're actually simpletons, you know, that they don't understand humanity at all. And I veer more and more towards that latter sense, that they don't understand the spirit of man. Particularly under travail, under pressure, and in extremis, that when you threaten the very existence of humanity, or above, even more emphatically than that, when you threaten the children of humanity, they will kill you. They will kill you. And that day could be coming very, very much sooner than we think.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.